The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Families that go here, grow here.
Now we come back to talk at 9.35 to two of my friends, if I may take the liberty of calling you such. Adele Coffey, John Connolly. Good morning. Happy New Year to you both.
Many happy returns.
Lovely to see you. Guess what we're going to talk about? Books. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about different potential reads for people. But before we do that, did you have a good book year in terms of the what was beside the bed or what was distracting you and making you happy bookwise?
Yeah, lots of great reads this year and very diverse as well. I did a lot of non-fiction reading this year, more than I would usually do, I think. But there were lots of fabulous books as well. Maggie O'Farrell's book I really liked, The Marriage Portrait. Saw her go back to the 16th century again.
Great.
Really enjoyed that.
It's just before we get into the titles, do you think that the last 3 years, which we shan't discuss in any great detail, but has it changed your reading habits? I mean, did you find yourself reaching for comfort, and are you ready for a change of direction, or did it matter at all?
No, I don't think it changed my reading habits, because I think if you were reading anyway, it did. I think what it did do was bring some people back to books.
Yes, I agree.
And make them realise, although one of the things that I was going to talk about was just how close I came to punching at least three people sharply on the nose over Christmas as they boasted about how they didn't read and seemed to regard it as reading novels on a level with collecting used bottle caps as a hobby. So for me, it didn't. But I do think it did bring some people who might not have read before back into the fold, because you had time on your hands and you did need to escape. And suddenly people realised how wonderful the possibilities of escape that books and novels offer us. And also that just this as a way of examining our lives. And I think it gave people time to do that, because one of the things you hear constantly is, I don't have time to read.
Yes.
But people will say, well, what have you been watching on Netflix, or what have you been watching on whatever it might be? So it's how they use their time. And I think when we had all of this time to watch TV, and so people thought, I can't watch TV all the time. I need to do something else.
Yes. You have completed the internet. You have completed Netflix.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, what are we going to do?
Watch
now.
Any more cats falling off tables on YouTube. And I think it did bring, because certainly the book trade did quite well over lockdown. And I hope people stayed with it. I think some people will stay with it.
Let us celebrate young people who also
Thank you, Ryan.
You're welcome, Adele. John, I know
the light is quite dim in here, must be said.
But no, I really mean that. I think that book talk, or whatever, for whatever reason, brought these younger people in. I can see it at home myself, and I'm just... Oh, my heart, it skips a beat when I hear them talking among themselves and friends about the classics that they're all going back to, as they are with music, which we're not going to go into now.
Sure.
But there's something great to be said. People can give out about online, as I do so regularly myself, but there's a bright light there as well.
Now, we've always talked about communities of readers, and I think that's what BookTok has done, has given young people that sense of being part of a community of readers. Especially previous generation, you might have felt like a bit of a geek if you were the person trying to find someone who was reading. And now it's actually very easy to reach out and find people with the same interest that you have, which is a way that really wasn't for us, I don't think.
Geekism and nerdism is as I've often said, to be celebrated, as you
know. They're very underrated.
It's a badge of honour. And, you know, I can see sometimes in recent years, you can see some people trying to embrace it, but they clearly aren't either of those things. But that's for another conversation. Let's talk books. Let's go fireside, cozy, you know, because people, it's January, it can be quite a long month for people. And if the bills are rolling in, you can go to the library, obviously, and you go to the bookshops for books. I think reading is so democratic, as we know, in that sense. Let's ease the mind, Adele. What's nice and steady as she goes?
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of sort of reading as a prescription, reading as a way of making yourself feel better, or reading as a way of sort of bouncing yourself into a different frame of mind.
It's a soother.
A complete
It's
soother.
A soother.
It's kind of weird though now. I'm thinking of a baby soother.
You're thinking of a dodie. It's like a soother with words.
Okay. It's very soothing, let's say.
That metaphor is cracking. You're stretching it so much now.
I'm talking to two acclaimed novelists. It's about the guy who could barely write a comic. I'll reverse and let you off.
No, not at all. But yeah, I love, you know, at Christmas time I read differently. I always save a big, huge book for Christmas. And this year's one is Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, which is a rewriting of
David Copperfield.
Did
you read it?
I'm in it at the moment.
How is it?
Oh, I'm absolutely absorbed. I'm loving it. Yeah. It's a complete world in the same way that Dickens' Copperfield is a complete world. And you've got all of these amazing characters, families, and connections and cousins living out in Knoxville. And it's set, it's sort of taking on American politics, obviously, and also the opioid crisis specifically. And it's just completely absorbing. And if you do want to, I know the opioid crisis is not necessarily an escape, but this novel is an escapist pleasure to read because Damon Copperhead himself, the main character, is absolutely so beautiful. You fall in love with him and you fall in love with him, you want to just protect him because
his struggle becomes yours.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay, I love that. I love that. But yeah, cozy fireside reading, you know, mysteries and cozy crime has done incredibly well during the pandemic. People wanted a complete escape. They wanted to feel like the good guy wins in the end. There's a solution for every problem. And I completely understand that. And if you're looking for a book like that, and you read this one, I think you had Lucy Foley on your show.
Before, not on this book, but yes, The Paris Apartment was our latest one.
Very much like an Agatha Christie locked room style mystery. It's set in an apartment in Paris, you may be surprised to hear.
Yes.
And it's basically this young woman, she lives in London. She goes to Paris to find refuge with her brother who lives there. But when she gets to his apartment, he's nowhere to be seen and there's just a bloody cat in the apartment. And so it basically involves all of the...
I just said the bloody cat. The cat wasn't slaughtered.
A bloody cat.
This is just your choice of words.
No, the cat was covered in blood.
Yeah.
Again, we're getting into pedantics and semantics here, aren't we? So it involves all of the characters who live in that lovely Haussmann building. And she describes Paris so beautifully. She describes the apartment building so beautifully and all the secret back doors and that kind of thing. And there's a lot about class in it. And there's a...
Complicated family,
adopted, and there's a secret at the heart of the novel as well.
Say no more. That'll do lovely. And that's Lucy Foley's The Paris Apartment. John, the fire is burning, the logs are crackling.
I brought the book I'm reading actually at the moment. I go back to Woodhouse. I couldn't like anybody who didn't like P.G. Woodhouse. I'd just walk away.
It's now a good time to say I've never read Woodhouse.
Okay. All right.
Goodbye, John.
Yeah,
I really want to read Woodhouse.
I always spotted signs of weakness in both of you, but I didn't think they were terminal.
No, I was too young when I started reading one of them, and I just thought this is so English tea and muffins and scones. I couldn't. Now maybe there was a Hibernian reaction to it in the Hives, but as a much older man now, you're recommending we go back to these things.
I'm recommending we go back to it because I think. Because you mentioned the opioid crisis, I thought, that's not that cozy. I wanted a book in which nobody gets hurt. The worst thing that happens to anyone in Joy in the Morning, the book I've chosen, is that somebody gets beamed on the back of the head with a hockey stick by an overeager Boy Scout. That's it. Nobody gets their heart broken and nobody dies. It is a kind of perpetual summer. And the only real threat is aunts and people who want you to marry them when you don't particularly want to get married. But what I love about them is that I think the circumstances of the publication of the book are really interesting. This book was published in 1946. And Woodhouse was coming through. He was in the middle of a very traumatic period in his life. He had begun this book at the start of the Second World War when he was in France. And then he was interned with his wife. And the Nazis obviously separated them and then released him from internment when he was 60. Okay. And Woodhouse was quite a naive man in many ways, I think. And they put him up in a hotel and they kind of said, oh, Woodhouse, we're very sorry for what happened. You know, you're a humorist and you don't really have any part in this war. Maybe why don't you like writing? Why don't you write about your experiences and maybe you'd like to talk about them? And Woodhouse, in a kind of fit of whatever it might have been, relief, made 6 broadcasts. Now, he did this at a time when Lord Haw Haw was broadcasting to England. Woodhouse didn't think anything about it. But he was immediately accused of committing treason, of fraternising with the enemy. And he was going to face trial when he got back to England. And Lord Haw obviously ended up being hanged. And it was only in 1946 that Woodhouse was told that actually charges probably won't be pressed. But I think he was so ashamed when he realised what he'd done and so frightened that he went to America and he never returned. So this quintessentially English writer never sees his homeland from... the end of the 1930s until he dies in 1975. And so while there's a glow of nostalgia to all of these books for a world that's, and it's not just English, it's a world of gentleness and kindness that has passed irrevocably at that stage. But you also have to recognise what's burning in the corner, which is this 6 years of history. And Woodhouse's own hopes and dreams. So I find the books very poignant when you read them in that way. They are cosy. There is an Englishness to them, but there is a joy. The book is not misplaced. And I think Joy in the Morning is probably the loveliest of his books. And it comes out of those awful circumstances.
All right. Okay. I'm feeling a summer read, funnily enough, in that way.
Well, sometimes when you're sitting looking at the rain miserably falling on you, maybe you kind of want to escape from that.
Do you know what I'm not great at is sad books. Books that make me sad. I don't like seeing books that's where not to pretend I'm Miss Universe, but I hate seeing kids in trouble or injured or you know, that kind of thing. I don't like really grim, you know, relationshipy stuff. So what is that normal, or do you know, when you see a book, do you find yourself drifting towards?
I'm with you. I remember one of my abiding traumatic memories of childhood is being in Butlins with my family, being forced to watch a Shirley Temple film and running from it in tears. Yeah. So I'm the guy, you know.
You're the wounded warrior.
The wounded warrior you don't want on your side if he's going to be crying at a Shirley Temple film and heading for the exits. I'm a bit like you. And I think as I got older, and we all now have families. Yes. You don't really want books about, and I write books in which occasionally children, but I'm very careful about how I present it because I think there's that awful sense of almost tempting fate. I think in a way that you're getting too close to something that you never ever want to have to experience.
Right, and there's also the idea of, I think, like for me, reading is it's that, like, I'll get up early, like really early to read, and I'll go to bed early to read, rather than people say, where do you get the time? Well, you just
You
make the time. As you said earlier on, you turn off the TV. But if that's going to be my time, I really don't want to invite all that awfulness into my head, because I think, you know, there's enough awfulness in the world.
I really do enjoy a good bleak read from time to time, and I do like a realistic one. And one of the books that I was recommending for a cosy fireside read is Amor Towles' Gentlemen in Moscow, because the entire world loves it except for me, and as far as I recall, you, because we reviewed it.
And I couldn't get into it at all, even though people I love swore by
it. It's beautifully written, but it's so escapist as to be unnaturally kind of escapist. It skips over the Second World War completely, as if it never happened, for example. So those kind of things really, I need a certain amount of realism in my escapist fiction, but it doesn't have to be bleak. But I don't know, I think it's a fear-based thing. I like to read bleak fiction. I like to read the scary stuff as a way of sort of knowing the outer boundaries of what can happen. Like if I can imagine the worst case scenario, I feel like I can protect myself from it in a way.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's taking you into the psychological outposts on a tour to see.
It's a flaw in me.
It's not a flaw at all. No, this is what reading does. It inspires conversations and ideas. I mean, my comfort read was murder and mystery, which was Louise Penny from Canada, who I spoke about at length last year. But I also loved Lucy Worsley's biography of Agatha Christie, if anyone's curious about the woman herself.
And her documentary was on.
And her documentary was on. And I see the one that one of my brothers gave us at Christmas was Lessons in Chemistry. Have you heard about this?
I have it, and I haven't read it to my shame.
I was kind of about 50 pages in going, I'm not sure about this. It's kind of trying to be the big American novel almost. It reminded me of Fleischman is in trouble. And it reminded me a little bit of Tom Wolfe later years. And then another person I know said, stick with it, it's really good. I stuck with it. So glad I did. I'm nearly over halfway through it. And it's a great old read, I must say. So that comes with the recommendation. I don't know if it's cozy necessarily, but it's just a great read. What else have you got for us, John? If we talk about escape, let's go. Let's escape.
Well, I was torn between I could have moved Woodhouse and these books to, I could have alternated them, but I've opted for, when I want to escape, I always think of escaping into a whole universe, into a whole other world. And I've opted for Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels.
Never read Terry
Fantasy
Pratchett.
Fantasy gets a very rum deal, usually by people who haven't read it, and comic fantasy in particular, what appears to be comic fantasy. And Pratchett, before he died, wrote, I think, 41 Discworld books. And they touch on feminism and war and religion. And he uses the Discworld as a kind of funhouse mirror. It's like he reflects our world back as he peers into it. And they're wonderfully wise and funny and witty books in which every kind of human foible and folly is given to dwarves and inept guards and dragon breeders. And it should be foolish and it should be silly. And no matter how you try to explain the Discworld to somebody, it does sound like you're talking about something very childish. But in fact, it's something very, very adult.
Yes.
But he has found a way to talk about all of these things in a way that's funny and witty and clever. And towards the end of his life, he began to succumb to Alzheimer's. And yet he continued writing. He continued writing with the aid of his assistant. And there's a kind of wobble probably around 38 and 39. And then the final book, The Shepherd's Crown, is just gorgeous. He had this one last flaring of this extraordinary imagination. And the great thing about it is that you can pick them up anywhere. Anybody who's read them and has fallen in love with them will have a favourite. I like Lords and Ladies and Guards and Witches Abroad. I think they're lovely books. And when you get to the end of them, you'll have forgotten what happened in the first one. So you can go back to the start again and they will be the gift for a lifetime.
This is something that I saw at Christmas as I get a little older. As I get a lot older, I find movies are doing that. Films are great now because I can go back to a film I saw in 1992, 3, 4 and go, no, don't remember one bit of it. I've seen that, watch it from scratch. Did you ever read Terry Pratchett?
No, but I have one Terry Pratchett story which involves John Connolly.
Let's hear it.
Many, many years ago when I was a young impressionable journalist and working in the Tribune, which backed onto the Merrion Hotel. So we used to fall into the Merrion Hotel to have a glass of wine after work. Bumped into John Connolly there one night who happened to have Terry Pratchett in tow.
Yes.
I did interviewing for the Yes. Irish Times.
Yeah. And so we sat down and we all had a drink together and Terry Pratchett left early and I thought, God, he's an awful grumpy man, isn't he? To my shame, the next day I spoke to his publicist who said, oh, we've had a terrible night. Terry Pratchett has had a heart attack and is in hospital.
I got the call from the publicist going, what did you do to Terry Pratchett? I remember that was his first words and I didn't do anything. He said, we haven't been in hospital. And in the background, I could hear Terry Pratchett shouting, going, I could buy this hospital.
Oh, my God. I'm kind of feeling palpitations just looking at you, Adele, in case something, because you bring on a heart attack. Okay, there's a few other bits and pieces. One thing I loved in recent times is the reinterpretation of the Greek myths. I'm up for that. This is the Pat Barker, excuse me.
I adore them too.
The Women of Troy and the Silence of the Girls. And then I looked at Madeline Miller's, I read The Song of Achilles, which I really enjoyed that. And I have a few at home now. I've got Ithaca and I've got the one with the Medusa and all. It's kind of waiting to go, but their time will come. It's like a taxi rank. I'm sure you're the same with the books. But I love that. The Greek myths seen through kind of feminist prism is probably a bit glib
to
say.
Well, it's a bit
off-putting,
I think, to say like that. Yes. Because actually, they're fantastic stories. And you've got, like, so you've recommended two of the most brilliant writers, I think, of our times, Pat Barker and
Madeline Miller.
Madeline Miller, she's a phenomenal writer. And all it is an amazing storyteller who uses the most beautiful language and tells the most amazing stories that we've known for our entire existence
as
humanity.
Though. They've been fresh. It's
completely
like when you take
fresh.
Your duvet and you give it a flick and you go, there it is. You know?
But they're page turners. They're absolutely page turners.
Yeah.
And what's brilliant about Pat Barker is she uses completely colloquial language. The women have these conversations together where they're talking about, you know, what a brute this guy is and who's having sex with who. And it's really so modern in its way.
It's almost soapy.
She's defended it in the sense of like, you know, we're human beings. We've always chatted to each other like this.
Lads, the text just in massive number of... It's very reassuring to hear that our friends listening in are big fans. John or Adele, John Connolly, Adele Coffey joining us, recommend a good graphic novel. I'm drawn to them for some reason, excuse the pun, I'm sure, but don't know where to start, says Dan. I'm a fan of the graphic novel. Any standouts between you both, or are you not?
I recently bought the whole Heartstopper collection for my 11-year-old boy as a way to sort of bounce him back into reading because he'd stopped reading. And he absolutely flew through them, adored them. They're a romance between two schoolboys. I think they're young adult fiction, but I think people might enjoy them. And then there's another one called The Rivers of London, Ben Aronovich. Yeah, which is kind of like murder mystery detective stuff with a supernatural twist.
Okay. John, have you graphic novel thoughts?
Not since Tintin, but I do return to them.
Tintin? I never saw Tintin as a graphic novel. That makes perfect sense. I read three books over Christmas as Una Monaghan in Leitrim. Shuggie Bain, excellent but harrowing. The Paris Apartment, overrated. The Tenth Circle by Jodi Picoult, typical Jodi. Moral Dilemma versus Bound. Very readable though. So Happy New Year. Great read is The Trees by Percival Everett.
That is
somebody
fantastic.
Else. You love that?
That's a fantastic book.
Pascal Donoghue, our minister for... he's not finance now. It's
public enterprise. Glad to help you out there. Wait to keep your finger on the pulse there, Ryan.
Lessons. I know. It's been. I still reek of turkey. Lessons in chemistry is great, says Pascal. I agree regarding Terry Pratchett. Beautiful novels. Can remember the gift I received as a kid of the first Discworld novel, and that is so important. That first book that you give to a young person because they stand. Can't believe you've never read Pratchett, right? The most intelligent satire you will ever come across, with the most human characters, even when they're animals. They are hands down the best mirror to humanity that you could ever read. Cannot recommend them highly enough. Don't know how you texted that while you were talking to me at the same time.
He wasn't listening to me, clearly.
Ryan, at 5 a.m. this morning, I finished Stephen King's amazing new book called Fairy Tale. I read it over Christmas. What a story. It's a wonderful adventure that transports the reader on a roller coaster you never want to get off. It's just fabulous.
I was going to include Mary. Stephen King in my escapist fireside stuff, but I realised that, again, it was a bit dark. But I just think he's one of the most wonderful storytellers. And again, you escape into the world. You forget about your world when you're reading his books, I think.
I read two books that are coming out, I think, in March. Liz Nugent.
Oh, my God. Wow, that book.
What's the
Have
name
you finished
of
it?
I finished, of course.
Strange Sally Diamond.
Strange Sally Diamond. It's abduction. It's dark as hell. But there's, of course, with Liz, there's a glint in the eye. So that was a great, like, I must say. We look forward to doing that.
Get your hands on it the minute it comes out. It will knock your socks off. I screamed out loud twice. And
really?
I bet you could guess.
Yeah,
the
of course
at
I
which.
Could. Yeah, yeah.
It's so shocking and it's so psychologically brilliant. It's just like her understanding of human nature and humanity is. It's very impressive.
You're in for a treat. And Joseph O'Connor's new one, My Father's House, about Monsignor O'Flaherty, is good too. Very good too. I read that.
I have it and I've just literally started reading it.
Have you another one coming out? You must have your next one. Not, oh, right. She's laughing.
I will. I do, of course. No, the paperback is coming out in February of Breaking Point, but the next novel will be out in 2024.
John, congratulations on your recent nuptials in November. It's a great news story. I'm delighted for you.
I'm
very happy for you.
Thank you. And
wish you well. I presume your last book came out not too long ago, didn't it?
Yeah, I have a sequel to The Book of Lost Things out in September.
In September.
16 years. So, yeah.
Wow, wonderful. Well, that's great. Listen. The first thing you said when you came in here was you need 2 hours for this show. When you guys are guests here, we need 6 hours because this could go on and on and on. We'll fix that another day, I'm sure. But John Connolly, Dale Coffey, to you and your families, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed talking to you.